God says, is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the courtroom for a hearing on the in the matter of the petition of the Wisconsin Trust Account Foundation for a rule assessing members of the State Bar of Wisconsin for an annual sum to support organizations that provide civil legal services to the indigent of this state. This is a proposal by the Wisconsin Trust Account Foundation, and periodically you'll hear us talk about IOLTA, and that is part of the history of WISTAF. The presenter is going to be John Skilton, who signed the petition, and then I have a list of appearances. And the list is long, and so I'm going to put a time limit on this list. And I'm going to read the list of names, and then I'm going to ask anyone who is not on the list and who wants to make a statement to please give the name to Cornelia Clark. She's up at the Supreme Court, and she will add that. And I'm going to ask if you're appearing in favor or against, because what I'm going to try to do today, which is not the way you usually do it, is I'm going to have one person for and then against, and then keep that balance to the extent we have names appropriate. Steve Glynn. Mr. Glynn? I don't see. Oh, there you are. I assume you're pro because you're... Okay, that's fine. Pat Morris, pro. John Abbott. Okay, no one surprised me so far. Owen Durgan, you announced you were opposed. Okay. Robert, and is it... I'm sorry, I can't pronounce your name. Chiapaglini? Chiapaglini, sorry. And you're...
Favor.
Oh, pro, okay. Steve Levine, opposed. Yeah, you sent a written material. Juliet Brody. Okay. Bobby Peterson. Michelle Banky. And James Botsford would be in favor if your letter is, you're supporting your letter or materials, okay. All right. Good. We're going to do several ground rules. One, many of you have submitted written materials, which the court has received and has read. So it would be appreciated if you did not read your materials to the court, and if you just stress those items you wish stressed in the interest of time, and because I think the court's familiar with these issues. Okay, Mr. Skilton, how much time do you want, considering the court wants an extra?
May I ask? Yes, may it please the court, John Skilton. I am a presenter and lawyer for WISTAF. What are the time limits that apply, and how would I...
Well, you will have, especially since Mr. Glynn, who is with WISTAF, and Pat Norris is here, we're going to give you 10 minutes. How are you going to do it?
I would like to reserve 5, if I may, so I'll try to be very efficient for a, if permitted, a response.
Okay. Well, why don't we give you, did I say 10? We'll give you 15, you can reserve 5, okay?
Thank you. And with respect to both Steve Glynn, who is the president of WISTAF board, and Pat Norris, they are here perhaps not to present but to answer questions.
Okay.
That would also be true of me. I have submitted what I would consider to be an opening statement to the court in writing. And so I'm going to address some issues that I think have some historical interest to the court, and then may drive to the purpose of the petition as I see it. Yesterday, returning from Washington, I passed a building that I often pass. And although we don't have 10 commandments that are legally a part of any courtroom in this country for reasons known to all seven of you, there is a commandment that is in stone on the building that we all report to. It's engraved, and it is equal justice under law. That is not a voluntary proposition. I suggest it's not even a hope. I suggest it's a command. It's a command that affects every one of you on the bench as it does every lawyer in this room. It is that purpose that is embedded in the reason that this court approved a mandatory bar. I would say it's the alpha and omega of the purposes, literally, that justify a mandatory bar. Now, I don't link the two discussions. I do link the obligations. I am an optimist on this issue. I have been pummeled on this issue over the years, as has the court, with issues relating to voluntary and mandatory. I think I can say to the court I've lived that fight in every form, both as state bar president in the ABA, watching the defunding of legal services, seeing the problems that this court is being confronted with in this petition. I do continue to believe that in the end the answer is voluntary. It must be, for reasons that I have tried to articulate. But the short term has to provide a solution. We, as lawyers, this court, must find a way to fund those persons who are in the business of delivering legal services to clients in need. It is a mission of the bar. It is a mission of the court. Historically, their funds have come from several sources, federally funded beginning in 68 and continuing through this day, now called the LSC, Legal Services Corporation. The first bump in the water was 1980. The second bump was 1994. And since that time, the numbers coming out of the Legal Services Corporation for funding that are partial pro rata to the states is roughly $300 million. Not even taking into account inflation. And that has resulted, as a matter of that source, in a relative defunding of our agencies as they are dependent upon that. Another source is IOLA funds. That's what we're talking about. That's why the WIS Staff Commission works. That barely escaped 5-4, swing vote being O'Connor-Brown case. But it did pass constitutional muster 2 years ago. It is those funds that have now been depleted by reason of a combination of the fact that banking practices have changed. To my understanding, IOLA accounts are not used as much, and or the transactions are so fast and instantaneous that interest can't be appropriately garnered. And in addition, of course, interest rates have plummeted. And as a result, that other portion of the funded part of the legal service agencies has been compromised to about 50%. When I was president of the bar, we were able to have the banks waive interest. We got it up almost to $2 million as of 97 and going up. But now it's down under $800,000, and the amount distributed is under $400,000, to my understanding. We are losing ground on those two primary sources. And what has the bar done about it? Well, we tried through the fund, and the Equal Justice Fund. And by the way, I am an optimist on this issue. It's half full. The Equal Justice Fund reformulated itself. We took out the administration. We had a relatively successful fund drive. We hit 220, and it's my hope to replicate the Boston Bar's success in this area, which takes the large firms who can afford this and say, you pay up here and you be a part of it, and hopefully we'll push this to a real amount, hopefully up to $1 million. It is my firm belief that voluntary giving has to come from those who make the most and take the most out of this profession, And that is the message of the Equal Justice Fund, and that is the message that we are trying to implement.
I have one question. What have other states done in this area as far as voluntary and mandatory?
Justice Wilcox, if I may, we just pulled from the ABA website this morning a full account given by, I forget the acronym, can we have 9 copies? We'll put it on the desk. So as to not guess, this is the ABA website as to a report on all aspects, how these funds are brought about by the 50 states and where they come from. Wisconsin isn't doing very well, folks. We're 32nd in terms of funding, as I understand it. And we're not doing anything on the public funds. I'm going to get to public funds in a minute because I think that's an important part of this discussion and should concern the court. Let me stay. I'm sorry, Justice Abrahamson.
You were talking about the fact that there are voluntary contributions, and your hope is that they will continue. And maybe you don't want to talk about this, but at least an argument has been made that mandatory funding, mandatory assessment, would be unconstitutional, comparable to the lobbying instance, a free speech issue.
First, I don't think it is free speech, and I'll tell you why in a minute. The court is well aware that I've argued this case twice in the Seventh Circuit. Mr. Levine argued one of them. So if the court has 30 minutes, I'll give you a full answer, but I'll give you a precise answer here. The bar is constitutional because it follows its core purposes. I was there on the day that Judge Crabb's decision issued, thrown at me by Scoop Nevitz, saying, well, I won't tell you what he said. And there the issue was speech. You had the court ask me when I was representing the bar, what does ideological mean? That was a tough question at the time, but I can tell you this. The proscriptions on the bar relate to speech issues. I do not view this as a speech issue. This is not a First Amendment issue. It goes to the core purposes of the bar. It is the reason that the Keller court approved a mandatory bar, that if the bar functions pursuant to its core purposes, and this is a core purpose, and things that it does in realization of that core purpose are constitutional by reason of why the bar is founded in the first instance. Judge Crabb said there was no purpose for the bar. It no longer was doing legal education, and discipline had been taken away from it, therefore had no reason to be mandatory. And I disagreed with that proposition as a lawyer, and I disagreed with it as bar president, and I took the bar into its constitutional areas in two commissions. One was the Legal Services Commission, one was the Legal Education Commission. Those are the mandatory purposes of the bar. In my judgment, they are the alpha and the omega of the bar's reason for being mandatory. If it wants to be a trade association and advertise, go ahead and do it. But those are the functions of, as the court knows in its dissent, this is the reason you have an organized bar. This is the reason why we as lawyers have to join together to meet those problems that are ours to solve. Yeah, they're the public's too, and I'll go to that if you want to. I'm probably out of time, but...
No, you're still on our end.
I do not think there's a constitutional issue. That's my... And I said it for the reasons I stated in my memorandum. I don't find a constitutional distinction here if it is administered by a Supreme Court agency for the purpose of supporting legal services.
My understanding that there have been several states, at least two or three, that do assess lawyers... and they were over the objection of the bar and others. Have there been any lawsuits on that?
I have. I didn't look at it personally, but I had my colleague, David Onstead, search for all of the ones we cite in our petition. He could find no follow-up precedent. I am unaware of one that directly addresses this issue. I cannot sit here and tell this court with a straight face that it will not be sued. on this issue. I got sued, by the way. The reason I didn't do Thiel is that I was a defendant then. I had become bar president. So there's no guarantee here, but I do think that you can pull from the principles of Keller and Brown and distinguish it, I might say, to the court constitutionally from mandatory pro bono. I have a whole different view of mandatory pro bono, pro bono, not that it's relevant, but I don't think you can force a legal lawyer-client relationship properly on people, particularly in areas in which they may not be competent. But even that is debatable. This is not that. If you look at it in First Amendment terms, by the way, you might even look at this as least restrictive means. $50 is a reasonable amount. It can be part of the bar dues statement. It can be devoted to the core purposes of the bar. You know, if it was unconstitutional, it's probably unconstitutional for me as bar president to recommend that we fund for $50,000 a study that related to how we get the private bar to donate. It's the same issue as far as I'm concerned, use of monies for core purposes. We've already done that. We've been there. And my answer to those who would say it's unconstitutional is that it, not that I'm giving the court an opinion because the court makes its own, but in my view, it is certainly defensible and clearly so under the proper abstraction of the fundamental principles of Keller and Brown.
Mr. Skelton, before your time is up, I'd like you to take, I know the red light's on, but I'd like you to take a minute or two to tell us about the public's responsibility here. And there I'm talking specifically about taxpayer responsibility.
If the court will indulge me a little bit on this, I can take this back 10 years. The bar has always felt, and I'm speaking now the bar, not in this hearing, but let's call it generically, that this issue is not just a lawyer's issue, it's a public issue, and it should be. When I was president, George Steyer and I sat, there's a hearing, it's not a court hearing, I'll give you anecdotal evidence based on my own knowledge here. I don't think that's unethical. Sat in Governor Thompson's office and asked for help. Governor Thompson was not unsympathetic. The result of that request, which I think was in the neighborhood of $500,000 a year, was that it was in the budget and then taken out 8-8 on a committee vote led by the Republican 8. We almost had one, lost it, and we got $100,000 of TANF money for 2 years. Those are federal monies that were directed. Last Thursday, I sat with the governor of this state and forwarded a request, now at the DOA, for $1.25 million for 1 year next year and 1 year thereafter. The governor was sympathetic. The governor, I believe, will make an effort here to try to get it. The commission this little group had that was there was a tough one. Find a way to balance it out in the budget. I got to have something to sell here. These are tough times on the budget. This court knows it. Some sufficient, some certain. CCAP. District attorneys. Who gets what? Does the court have enough? What about filing fees? Those are issues that just anyone who's been in this area knows these are the issues that are around the country. One of the alternatives around the country is filing fees. Why don't we take filing fees and do it well? You're the broadcast on that one. So the answer to the question is, yes, public funds, in my opinion, should be part of the solution. But they're not yet, and may never be. And in the meantime, we have to have something that permits our legal service agencies, even at the minimal listic levels that they're now delivering service at, to continue. There can't be a credible case of no need. That is silly.
Thank you, Mr. Skelton. You will have the opportunity to wrap up at the end. I'm going to now ask Mr. Owen Durgan. You'll be limited to 7 minutes, Mr. Durgan. Is our fantastic equipment go that way? Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm opposed to this petition strictly on constitutional grounds. I'm all in favor of their objectives. I think they're good, honorable people with a good objective. I just think that this is not constitutional. I respectfully question the court's jurisdiction to even entertain this petition. I assume that it's under the court's general supervision and regulation of the practice of law, but I fail to see where this is related to the practice of law. If you look at all of the other bar assessments like the OLR, that's related because the profession, through a minority of its members, has damaged the public. So the profession then, through the organization, is going to help the public. And whatever assessment is, that's to make up for what the minority has done. And the client security fund, it's the same sort of thing. So there's a relationship between something the bar has done and something they have to make up for. But I don't see anything like that here at all. The only thing that I could that I could come up with is that if the court were to determine that the bar's hourly rates were so extremely high as to cause this problem, then I can see where an assessment might well be in order. But I think that this is kind of flawed from the beginning because it's based on this IOLTA as a supplement to IOLTA, which the U.S. Supreme Court, as you all know, determined that this was unconstitutional. It was an unconstitutional taking and without just compensation, but what they said is that the just compensation just sort of evaporated because it was broken up into such small accounts that people wouldn't have gotten the money anyway. In my view, it's still embezzlement of client funds. It reminds me of a case I heard of about 30 years ago where an employee of a large bank who was in charge of the computer system decided to take one penny out of every customer's account per month and put it in his own account. Well, that worked for quite a while. I mean, who's going to miss a penny a month? Who cares about a penny a month? Doesn't matter. But it did amount to quite a good income supplement to his income. Of course, that's embezzlement. I submit in this case, unless the court has or can come up with a good justification for this, that basically this is a type of extortion. And if that term is too strong, then I would say that as a minimum, it is also an unconstitutional taking without just compensation. But in this case, the just compensation wouldn't evaporate. It's attached to every attorney. So that could all be refunded. So I submit that if the court still feels they have, apparently do have the jurisdiction on this, that if they were to pass it, that this would be wide open to a suit by any member of the bar. And just based on what happened to IOLTA, they would have to, I assume the court, U.S. Supreme Court, would have to view this also as unconstitutional, but now they have no way to say that the just compensation evaporates. So that's the reason. I'm all for the objectives of this, but I just don't think that it can pass constitutional muster.
What is your proposal?
Well, I think that the bar is missing a chance to get a public relations bargain. I suggest that the bar. That the Board of Governors, now I haven't looked at the bylaws of the bar. I don't know if they can do this. Mr. Skilton talked a little about this, but I think the bar should, if they have the authority, should just assess the members. They should raise the bar dues, not assess, just raise the bar dues by $50 per year for something that's a very selfish reason. But it's just good for the bar. It's good for their image. Right now, it's looking worse than ever with the with this very petition and them fighting it. So I would suggest that for a dollar a week per attorney, if I were a member of the bar, I would say, man, that's a bargain. So I would just suggest that the bar do this on their own. They're going to look good. And I also feel that the public funds should be available. I know the budget's tight and all, but the state of Minnesota came up with $7 million a year. I would think that that the Wisconsin could have come up with, say, $1 million, which would be more than what they're asking for here. I think that a factor, the high bar hourly rates, may be a factor in this. And again, I submit to the court that the practice of law needs to be opened up to independent paralegals to help bring these rates down, and to force the bar to utilize paralegals for more than just the routine dog work. Paralegals can be used for substantive legal work, drafting complaints, briefs, and the whole thing, but the bar just doesn't use them that way. So I think that would be a big factor right there in bringing these high rates down, which may help this somewhat.
Could I ask, could you just be very succinct and explain to me precisely what the difference is between a $50 a year assessment and a $50 increase in the bar dues?
The difference is the bar is doing it voluntarily. That's the big difference. If it's not being extorted from them, they are voluntarily saying that they're going to, you know, they may tell the public they're doing it to help the poor, but and maybe a lot of them are, but a lot of them, I would say that this is in their own selfish interest of improving the bar's image.
An import of Justice Prosser's question is that the court mandates that lawyers pay the bar dues. When the bar says pay up another 50, it is mandated by this court that that 50 be paid. So whether it's done initially by a bar resolution or done initially by this court, the end result, and if I'm wrong, Justice Prosser will correct me, the end result is it's a mandate on all the lawyers of the state. So what the difference I hear is you'd raise it up to $52 rather than $50 a week.
I would still submit that the big difference is that the bar itself is doing it. If somebody comes up to me and says, I need $5, I'm hungry, I might give him $5, but if he comes up and says, you have to give me $5, I'm certainly not going to give him $5.
Mr. Durrigan, regrettably, this court passes and approves all of the bar dues. I mean, we have the authority to go up and down on the bar dues.
Yes, I appreciate that, but the point is this would still be coming from the bar. It would still be coming from the bar.
Mr. Durrigan, thank you, and we understand your position.
Thank you very much for that.
Mr. Glenn.
Yeah, please, the court. My name is Stephen Glenn. I'm here not as counsel for an agency, but rather as, at least at the moment, president of that agency. And the agency filed the petition and sought counsel as it did because the need, which is demonstrated by everything that has been filed with this court, is simply getting beyond our control. And among discussions at the WSSTAF board meetings, which, as this court knows, consists of not only lawyers but also non-lawyer members of the public, primarily people who have financial backgrounds in accounting or banking, discussed lots of alternatives. And what it came down to, Your Honors, was really a very simple proposition. We view ourselves as a creature of this court. We wouldn't exist but for this court. And we need some guidance from Your Honors as to just what our mandate is. Because of what I would describe as communication deficiencies, one of which, frankly, we have considered changing by perhaps suggesting an alteration of the WSSTAF rules to see if we could get a member of this court on WSSTAF's board. But our communication problem is that although we issue annual reports to the court, I personally don't feel that we have been able to communicate the urgency of our situation. Now, either Mr. Skelton and our executive director and our president and past president are correct, and we have really a direction from this court to try to help legal services in this state through fees directed through IOLTA and such other means as the court allows, or we don't. And if it's the latter, if it is in fact the court's intention today to say that when we created Chapter 13 of the SCRs, and you know, it's one of those things that we say all the time, but sometimes I think we don't listen to it well enough. SCR, for the public who's here that is not among the legal profession, are Supreme Court rules. The Supreme Court in this state controls what happens to this profession and sets what we hope are ideals and goals for this profession. And we don't think that this court, with all respect, when it created Chapter 13, meant to have an agency that really did nothing but take IOLTA money and give it away.
Justice Bradley,
is it your position that the mandate of WSSTAF should be expanded? And if so, how is that to be accomplished?
It is my position, Your Honor, that we would like direction from the court as to whether our mandate is broad enough to cover this sort of petition, as well as the matters that were set forth in the last couple of pages of our additional statement submitted to this court, which I'm not bothering to reiterate because it's already before you, but that included other options. I mean, for example, is WSSTAF allowed to lobby, assuming it complies with lobbying laws, of course, but I mean, is WSSTAF allowed to go to the legislature? Is WSSTAF allowed to seek other forms of funding? We want to. Okay. We want to do whatever can be done because the state of provision of funds to legal services in this state is a disgrace. And at the moment, we happen to be the only kids on the block who are dealing with this.
Well, 1301C, you're familiar with that, 2C says the program is interest on the accounts.
Your Honor, I appreciate that.
1301 says the program shall be operated and administered by you. And I thought somewhere in this pack of stuff I have, and everybody else has, this proposal for reorganizing or restating 1301. Is that right?
Yes, and again, if I may, Your Honors, this is really the equivalent of the child game, Captain May I. I mean, we need to come to the court because we don't want to be chastised by the court for going way beyond our mandate, but at the same time, we are uncomfortable as an agency that we believe has been directed by Your Honors to try to do what can be done for legal services, to sit on our hands and say, IOLTA money is disappearing, so I guess legal services is just out of luck.
Justice Wilkins, do you still have a question?
Yeah, I do. You know, from everything that's been submitted, stepping over the initial question, which I think is the hardest one, can this first step be taken? From everything that's been submitted, $50 per lawyer is not going to solve our problems or come anywhere near addressing our problems in regard to the need that obviously is out there. Why the choice of $50? Is it just hoping for a first step to then take a bigger step later, or why the $50 choice?
It's a recognition, Your Honor, that as IOLTA funds have gone down, perhaps with a change in the economy, IOLTA funds will go up. And it's a recognition that we can't, in fact, ask lawyers alone to serve and solve the problems that poor litigants face in the state. We do not want to be seen as suggesting that we agree with the proposition that this is a lawyers-only problem. I will personally state that I think it is our view that lawyers do, in fact, have a bigger interest in this and have a higher obligation because of our duties to the public, our duties to pro bono, our duties to the provision of legal services to those less fortunate than ourselves. But if we were to ask for enough money to solve the problem, Justice Rogenczak, we would have really been saying, put this entire burden on the backs of lawyers. And we were not comfortable with that, simply.
Mr. Glenn, what about the bar's position that we really need to develop a long-term solution here and that this is really a stopgap measure?
To a certain extent, that's correct. But it is a stopgap measure in precisely the way that term is used. If we don't stop the gap, Your Honor, the courts are going to be in trouble because of pro se litigants. The litigants themselves are going to be in trouble. Your Honors have other petitions before you raising the issues of Gideon in civil cases. I do not dispute the fact that this is not going to solve the problems. And I do not dispute the fact that a long-term solution is necessary. This staff believes that we have to get this program started. And at the moment, as I said, we're the only kids on the block. Thank you.
Mr. Glenn, Justice Grasso.
The petition talks about the initial assessment shall be $50. How high could the assessment go before there was some problem, a legal problem?
I believe unlimited. That is, I believe that it is limited only by this court's exercise of its authority over the practicing bar. And I think that when the court says that this is a problem that exists only for the bar, that will raise the issue. $50, I don't think, even comes close. Could there be a case where that could develop to a problem? Sure. And when we say the initial request is at $50, that's because, as I was saying in response to Justice Rogenczak's question, we have to start somewhere. We don't want to lay it all on the backs of the bar. We don't know where the economy will go. We don't know how IOLTA funds will be handled. But again, I really would like to reiterate a point that was made during Mr. Skelton's comments. And that is that it is not simply a matter of interest rates. It's also really a fundamental change in the way IOLTA funds are in lawyers' accounts today from the way they were back when this program got started, when Chapter 13 came into being. In those days, there were substantial funds in lawyers' trust accounts. Now they're not, and frankly, that's what the U.S. Supreme Court used as its basis for allowing IOLTA funds to continue. So the use of the term initial request, Your Honor, was simply meant to encompass all of those interests.
Would this court have the authority to approve a rule making an assessment of $50 on attorneys for tsunami victims?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? If the tsunami victims are not in the state of Wisconsin, I'm not associated with the state of Wisconsin, and I'm not somehow encompassed within the obligation that lawyers take on when they take their oaths and when they accept the responsibility of providing pro bono services. Probably be without this court's authority would be my guess. But I can't represent to you that I've researched that. I can't represent to you that I've thought about that. As I indicated, I was trying to duck those kinds of questions before they came, Your Honor. When I said that I was here as the president and not the lawyer, that's really kind of what I was trying to hide from.
What if we had a disaster similar to the World Trade Center and court had an assessment to provide legal services for the victims in their dealing with the compensation board, the state, the airlines, etc.? What would your stand at a response be?
My response would be to applaud and to congratulate a court for having that kind of courage. Now, as a lawyer who cares about the Constitution, however, I guess it would depend on the limits that the court imposed there. I mean,
$50.
If it's $50 worth of money or effort or something like that, I would say that that's well within the court's authority. Well within. I think that the closest line that makes sense for constitutional purposes is the taking question. And I don't think there can be that question at this level or at the level in Your Honor's hypothetical.
And voluntary bars did do that, by the way, as you know.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I'm going to ask Michelle Behnke, president of the State Bar, who will represent the opposite position, to come forth. Attorney Behnke.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court, I'm Michelle Behnke, and I'm here on behalf of the State Bar. And I'm here in that capacity to oppose the WISDAF petition. On November 5th, 2004, the State Bar Board of Governors had a lengthy discussion on this issue. I'm proud to say it was substantive. And despite what newspaper reports have suggested, we were not quibbling over $50. The board understands the needs that are being outlined by WISDAF's petitions, and we're certainly more than sympathetic to those needs. But we don't believe that a mandatory assessment is the way to accomplish an overall solution. What the board determined was that it would support a 2-year voluntary assessment. It would be handled on our due statement, and this would do several things. Most importantly, it would allow each lawyer to assess what he or she is already doing.
And do you know, as part of your petition, what is the bar doing? I mean, do you know in the actual figures, the hours, the time?
We do not have precise data on what lawyers are doing in the way of pro bono service. One of my predecessors in an article surmised as his best guess that lawyers were providing something on the neighborhood of 100 hours of pro bono service by direct legal service, service on nonprofit boards, etc. That predecessor, doing a rough calculation, suggested that at an hourly rate of $100 an hour multiplied by the number of lawyers in the state, that would result in something in the neighborhood of $100 million worth of service. Now, I don't have data to support that, but in written form, a predecessor eyeballed it in that fashion.
Counsel, I understand that there's a difference between doing pro bono work and reporting pro bono work.
Certainly.
In one of the arguments advanced against voluntary and in support of mandatory is the experience
that the bar encountered. Previously, this court had before it a petition for mandatory reporting of pro bono work. The court did not adopt the petition. Chief Justice Heffernan, however, according to the information that I've read in these filings, sent with the next dues statement a letter encouraging attorneys to voluntarily report their pro bono hours, and apparently 3% responded to that voluntary request accompanying their dues by the Chief Justice.
And I would distinguish this. The request for the information was simply that. What the State Bar is proposing at this point, we have, for instance, on our dues statement, a blank line for people to contribute to the Wisconsin Law Foundation. That blank line requires a lawyer to stop, consider what the Law Foundation is, and if they want to make a contribution, and if they were to make a contribution, what dollar amount they would want to write on that blank line. This would be handled differently. The $50 would be listed on the dues statement, but individual lawyers would have the opportunity, having assessed their own activities, to decide for themselves to cross off that dollar amount.
You used to do that with the Wisconsin Law Foundation.
It was always a blank line, or I think at one time there was a $20 number in there, correct. But I don't mean to suggest that we're hoping for oversight, but I do suggest that by suggesting the amount and putting it in the blank line, that may produce a significantly different result. When I stepped up here, as you all know, I'm not a litigator. When I looked at this issue, it really boiled down to two very simple questions. Is the mandatory assessment wise, and will it work? And I'm going to suggest to you that I don't think it's wise, because it makes WISTAF the preferred fundraiser. Some of the earlier speakers indicated that they were the only kid on the block. But the fact of the matter is there are many legal service providers out there that are not funded by WISTAF. And right, wrong, or indifferent, with this assessment, it will affect fundraising efforts by other entities. It'll bring new meaning to the phrase I gave at the office.
Counselor, what do you think the bar's position might be if we were to approve a mandatory assessment for 3 years with a sunset provision, and it expires after 3 years, and we can see what other efforts are being made by other sectors of society to address a problem that's been acknowledged to be more than the bar's problem?
I've learned in my 6 months tenure never to try and predict what the bar might do on any particular issue, but let me suggest there are a couple of things that might be indicators. Mr. Skilton said himself, the public has a role in here, but we don't know, they're not there yet, and they may never be. I look to our neighbors in Minnesota, and there the bar did step up, and they did not object to the $50 in 1997. And this year they will be considering an increase of that assessment, an additional $75 for a total of $125. What I suspicion the objection will be is that once the assessment is made, even with a sunset clause, this will send a message to the public and the legislature and others that they can take this issue off their minds. They need not worry about it. They can simply go back to the lawyers and ask for an additional sum of money. And I think that if you limit the ultimate solution to that smaller group, when that group diminishes in size, you will not have a comprehensive solution.
My question on what the bar was doing now was, let's say, attached to the $50 contribution. It seemed to me that if there is this contribution, will it affect adversely the pro bono work that's done by the profession?
I have spent a great deal of time traveling around the state and talking to members. And many lawyers have suggested to me, and I don't have a quantified number, that if the assessment is made, they will pay it. That's their obligation. But they will either, they either see that as the definition of their obligation and would do no more, or they will, out of frustration, simply make that payment and cut back on pro bono or other contributions that they're making. Is that how it should be? Is that what everyone will do? I'm certain that's not the case. But it has been made clear to me that many people would take that approach.
Chief, if I may.
Justice Butler.
Ms. Benke, if I could follow up on Justice Rogenstein's question, because I do hear your concerns about if we approve the petition, might this send a message to the legislature to take this off the table? What about this court holding the petition in abeyance for 2 or 3 years, as Justice Rogenstein has suggested, to give the bar, I was intrigued by the bar's position of doing a study for a long-term solution, to give the bar an opportunity to look at this problem and try to come up with some long-term solutions, but in a mandatory fashion so as to solve the problem with legal services on a short-term basis.
I'm sorry.
In other words, a modified version of the bar's approach. Adopt the approach with the exception of making it mandatory and not ruling, granting, or denying the petition at this time, but holding it in the abeyance, waiting for the study to be done by the bar.
This court obviously could do whatever it wanted to do in terms of crafting the mission, but I again suggest that the mandatory nature of it in the short term may affect giving pro bono in other ways, which everyone agrees has to be part of the solution. I believe that the voluntary contributions in the short term, along with the study that has been suggested and is supported by the Board of Governors, will bring about that longer-term solution. But the negative impact, the negative perception by lawyers may hinder our ability to bring that long-term solution about.
Chief, may I ask Justice Bradley? Two questions. It seems to me that the objection that you might hear around the state isn't so much the amount of money, mm-hmm. but rather that it is being required rather than voluntary. Am I correct or incorrect on that?
It is a number of things. It is the required and the message that sends to lawyers, which suggests that they are doing nothing currently, as hopefully the justices have seen. To suggest that the bar as a whole is not meeting obligations is pretty darn close to an insult to me. I would take it as an insult on behalf of Beth Rooney Drennan. I mean, we have numbers of examples of people who are going above and beyond the call of duty of pro bono service, and many people are suggesting that they are doing their part, and to add the $50, 20:6.1 says, do pro bono or support organizations that provide the legal services, and if they chose to do one of those, that the additional $50 negates or ignores that.
One of the things I've learned on, as a member of this court is people have a variety of perspectives, and thus this perspective may not resound with other members of the bar. But when I think of $50, I took my son out to eat last night at a medium-priced establishment here in Madison, and the total bill and the tip was certainly more than $50. I think of I drive a SUV, and that's two tanks of gas. I'm not sure that would cause me to alter the way that I see my obligation or lack of obligation to do pro bono work. So I'm just myopic on that.
Well, let me say that, in fact, that is precisely what people suggested to me, that it was not the $50. It was not the actual dollar amount, but it was the mandatory nature and the signal or the statement that we don't believe that you're doing something and therefore we will mandate.
Chief, if I may, I have a second question to follow up, and that is I did read the minutes of the Board of Governors debate, and as you indicated at your threshold comment, I found them to be vigorous debate and discussion that befits an organization like the State Bar of Wisconsin. One of the things that was debated was whether or not this $50 proposal would include within that $50 money to fund a study. What's your understanding of the State Bar's position? Is the $50 to be towards the delivery of legal services, or as part of the $50 of the encompassed in the State Bar's petition to be diverted to fund a study?
Well, in having that vigorous debate, some of the details, shall we say, did not get fully worked out. But it would be my understanding, since I'm in fact working on putting together the budget for such a study, that the study would be coming out of the State Bar, would be addressed in the State Bar's regular budget, and the $50 was seen as what would be delivered to WIS staff. There are other things that were not discussed, like the administrative expense that the bar would also be undertaking in that collection and delivery, et cetera. And as I said, those details did not get worked out. But the gist of the discussion was that the $50 was the amount to be delivered to WIS staff. At one point, I believe there was discussion that 10 of the 50 could be segregated to fund the study. But at the end of the day, that was not part of the motion.
Thank you.
Ms. Binky, on behalf of the court, I do want you to know and advise the Board of Governors of the Bar, as well as members that you meet with, that the court is very well aware of the pro bono activities of many members of the Bar. We have attended many sessions of the Bar applauding such pro bono activities and awarding lawyers, legal service entities, and law firms for countless hours of service. And the Dane County pro bono group does the same, and the Milwaukee Bar Foundation and Bar Association do the same. They're the ones that are in the immediate area that invite me, so invite members of the court, so we're aware of those. But I'm sure that there are other entities all across the state that do that, including United Way, which supports legal services. So we're very well aware of the activities of the bar. And whatever happens here today or whenever it happens on this petition is not a disparagement of any bar activities, but a full recognition that they have occurred. And as you know, the symbol is a star, the starfish.
Yes.
So every single dollar, every single lawyer makes a difference.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Benke. Mr. Norris, Executive Director of WIS staff, you're a pro.
Your Honor, thank you. I am bubbling over with excitement over the petition. However, I will defer to my colleagues and not restate statements already made.
Thank you, Mr. Norris. I should say that the court meets and has for the last 2 to 3 years met with a variety of its agencies, entities, boards, and committees on almost an annual basis. WIS staff has not been on our list, and because it is a separate organized corporation, even though the organization was required through SCR 13, and maybe that's been an oversight that should be corrected in future years, regardless of what happens in this petition. So I would suggest, if that's what WIS staff wishes, you send me a letter. I would do it like in September when I start, maybe March is a better idea, when I start putting together the meetings we have with the various groups.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would certainly appreciate that. WIS staff has submitted, pursuant to the court rules,
right,
its annual reports.
Right, we get that.
But we would very much like to have the opportunity to visit with the court at your convenience.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Norris, could I ask a question? Is there anything that a Wisconsin attorney could give to your organization other than money?
Your Honor, your question goes to the heart of why WIS staff, or the way WIS staff is structured at the moment. The way we're presently structured, our sole responsibility is the distribution of the IOLTA accounts. I would suggest that the state bar has a very active pro bono section where they are trying to foster pro bono activities throughout the state. In fact, I noticed that Mr. Brown, the director of that, is here today. I think that if a Wisconsin lawyer was interested in doing pro bono work, it wouldn't go directly to help WIS staff, but it would certainly be in the benefit of, it can be organized by the state bar.
Thank you.
How does your proposal work? The assessment, is the assessment ultimately channeled to WIS staff, or who does the assessment go to?
The assessment would be paid with the bar dues, and our proposal was that it would be handled as other Supreme Court assessments are presently handled by the bar, and that would be the bar would pay the amount received via the bar dues quarterly to WIS staff, and then WIS staff would distribute it in the manner that it presently does. The point was made that there are other legal providers out there that WIS staff does not provide, and that is certainly true. And the fact that we don't provide funds or grants to them doesn't demean the quality of their work or the fact that WIS staff wouldn't want to do that. We, particularly in the last several years, have just in light of declining funds, have had to put our money where we thought we were going to get the biggest bang for the buck, and that's the bottom line.
So to just button this up, WIS staff and the bar's pro bono operations are completely separate.
That's true, Your Honor.
As well as the local bar association's activities.
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. We will now go to Mr. Levine. Mr. Levine is an attorney in Madison. And I assume you're appearing in your own right, not as a representative of your employer.
I hope so, Your Honor.
As your employer.
If it pleases the court, my name is Steve Levine. I'm a lawyer from Madison. I'm appearing here today not against anything, but in favor of something, in favor of the state bar's position on this petition, which I think is a fair and just compromise on the whole question. I think it's fair because, on the one hand, by placing on a lawyer's annual state bar due statement a $50 assessment, it brings home to every lawyer at least once a year the importance and the need to fund legal services for those who can't afford it. At the same time, by including an opt-out provision on that due statement, it also recognizes that pro bono is, has been, and always has been in Wisconsin, a voluntary, ethical, moral obligation, the decision of which is up to the individual attorney and not to government. Supreme Court Rule Chapter 20, 6.1 right now clearly indicates that the obligation to do pro bono is an ethical and moral obligation, not legally enforceable by government. Very early in its history, in a case going back to the 1800s, this court determined that mandatory pro bono is illegal and unconstitutional. And there's nothing in Section 7 of the state constitution which gives this court the right to either tax or to assess lawyers for pro bono purposes. So I think...
It's been a while, Mr. Levine, since I read that case, but was it on the grounds that it's servitude if you force the lawyer to do something?
I thought it was on the grounds of taking property without just compensation.
Okay.
Whatever the grounds. I think there's some important legal questions as to this court's authority to order mandatory pro bono. But my basic obligation to imposing mandatory pro bono on Wisconsin lawyers is that it takes away from each individual lawyer the right to decide for him or herself those charitable causes to which he or she wants to contribute and how much he or she wants to contribute. A lawyer may be a veteran and may want to give that $50 that's being requested by WSSTAF to veterans groups to help out soldiers who've lost arms or legs in various wars and conflicts. Or a lawyer may want to give that money to medical groups that travel all around the country, all around the world, doing good for people, or to medical research, or to the Salvation Army, or the Red Cross, or whatever. By adopting the WSSTAF petition without an opt-out proposal, this court would be saying, our judgment is superior to yours. You might think that contributing to this cause or that cause is at least as important or more important than contributing to legal services. But we're going to take that choice away from you, and we're going to make the choice for you to take $50 away from whatever causes you contribute to now, because we think this is most important. I think that pro bono and the voluntary nature of pro bono recognizes that it ought to be the choice of every lawyer to determine how much money and to which causes he or she wants to do pro bono, whether it's in the legal area or contributing to other charities. And I hope that the court won't take that choice away from each individual lawyer in Wisconsin. Nobody can argue. Now, you asked me at the very beginning, Your Honor, what my position was. Was I against the WSSTAF petition or for it? Nobody can be against funding legal services for those who can't afford it.
Question is only how.
The question is how, and the question is, do we want to take the drastic step of having this court be the conscience of every lawyer in Wisconsin and to say, this is the cause that you ought to contribute your money to. You might have different priorities. You might have given it a lot of agonizing thought as to who and to what you wanted to contribute to. But we're going to make this choice for you. And I hope the court won't do that. I hope you'll give the dignity and the choice to every lawyer in Wisconsin to make that decision for him or herself.
Counsel, do you believe that the lawyers of the state have an obligation to assist in providing legal services to the poor?
I think there's a definite moral and ethical obligation, yes. But I don't think it's a legally enforceable obligation by government.
Counselor, what about the argument that's being made that one of the purposes of the bar is legal education, and this court has said, lawyers, we know you all want to keep up to date, but notwithstanding that, we're going to require that you get certain amounts of legal education every year. And as provision of legal services to those that can afford it as well as those who can seems to also be within the scope of the bar. Why is this request by WSSTAF so different in regard to what the court's being asked to do?
We obviously possibly see things differently, Your Honor, but I don't think that funding a social program, a positive social program, can be considered in the same category as a regulatory expense to make sure that lawyers are practicing competently. I mean, one is a social program. I mean, it would be nice if every profession had its own branch of government, if doctors had their own branch of government that they could come to and say, we want you to force all doctors to make the same type of contribution that WIS staff is asking for, and home builders, and maybe even farmers to contribute food to the poor. But I think those are social programs, and they aren't in the way of, you know, a regulatory program that's there to make sure that the legal system works.
Mr. Levine, knowing that if this program were voluntary, that not every lawyer would contribute, do you think the dollar amount that's suggested ought to be higher, ought to be $100?
That might be a good idea. I think that's up to the bar. Of course, I think, I'm not sure if it was one member of the court earlier or one of the speakers indicated that the whole problem could be solved if the bar were a voluntary organization as it is in Minnesota. Then the bar could set whatever it wants, and then it would be a totally voluntary contribution up to each lawyer.
I don't think we're ready to go there again.
But not within the...
You've had a consistent theme.
But I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know how the two questions got combined with each other.
Mr. Levine, in utilities that are highly regulated, that provide essential services like gas, electricity, are they obligated in any form to provide to the indigent?
I think what the legislature has done is the legislature puts an assessment on everybody's utility bill that goes for various causes. But that's something that everyone pays for, not just a certain segment of society.
Everybody that uses gas and electricity, which is everybody.
And telephone. And telephone, yes.
And telephone. Thank you.
Mr. Levine, I'm thinking of two things, and I'm wondering if there is any application of these things to the problem at hand. In the Civil War, people were conscripted, but they could buy their way out of it. Our court operates with interns from the law schools. They put in tremendous amounts of work. They don't get paid, but they do get credit for their work. Is there some way that if people actually showed they were doing pro bono work and reported that they might be able to avoid a cash assessment? Or is there some way that pro bono work could get people credit for something? I'm talking about incentives, inducements rather than sticks.
I think there are a number of incentives that the court could try, and maybe your suggestion would be a good one. Maybe I'm coming from a peculiar moral and ethical background, but the way I was raised was that when you do anything good, whether it's pro bono, whether it's contributing to charity, whether you work for a private group, you do it privately and quietly, and it's nobody else's business but yourself. It comes from your heart. You don't do it because, now one of the speakers earlier suggested, gee, this would really be good public relations for the bar if the bar put this kind of assessment on its bar dues, because then the public would look at the bar and say, gee, they're good people. That's not why... In the way I was brought up, that's not why you do pro bono.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Levine.
Thank you.
We'll turn to John Abbott, Executive Director of Legal Action of Wisconsin. We have a communication from your office. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Abbott, we're going to ask you to delay your conversation for a moment because we have to change the CD where we are recording this hearing.
Thank you.
Ms. Jensen, if you'd approach the bench, please. Mr. Ebbett, Executive Director of Legal Action of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, as the Chief Justice said, my name is John Ebbett, and I'm Executive Director of Legal Action of Wisconsin, and I appreciate the opportunity this morning to address this issue. I wasn't going to repeat this because John Skilton said it in his initial remarks, but I think it needs repeating. What we're talking about here with this WSTAT petition is not just another cause, and it's not a social program. We're talking about equal justice under law in this country and in this state, and particularly in this state. Equal justice under law is of a far greater dimension and far greater gravity than just another cause or a social program. Those of us who are providers don't provide a social program. We try to provide justice to low-income people, that's as equivalent to the justice that people of means receive as possible. We try to do as good a job for our low-income clients as private law firms do for theirs. And that goes to the heart of what lawyers are and to the heart of what the legal profession is. And in this state, in Wisconsin, what we've done so far is we've chosen to provide this equal justice through a group of core legal services providers, and those are the providers that are funded by the Wisconsin Trust Account Foundation. They include Wisconsin Coalition for Advocacy, Wisconsin Judicare, Legal Aid Society Milwaukee, ABC for Health, my own legal services firm, Legal Action of Wisconsin. We've done it also through other methods, including pro bono and pro se clinics. And pro bono is useful, but pro bono will never supplant the core legal services providers that we've established in this state. Pro bono is helpful, but the legal services providers cannot be diminished and expect pro bono private attorneys to fill that gap if the providers are diminished.
Mr. Ebbett, do you utilize private counsel, pro bono attorneys, as part of your program?
Yes, we do.
Could you just briefly explain how you do that?
Because it's quite helpful to our delivery of legal services, and it fits in very well as a complement or a supplement to what we do. But we have around 1,517 private attorneys on our volunteer lawyer panel, and of that amount, since 1989, 977 have taken a case. And I'm sure you're familiar, a transactional attorney with a big firm is not that wild about taking an eviction, and most lawyers really don't want to take custody cases, and most lawyers really don't want to try to find out what the Medicaid regulations are about. So we utilize private attorneys in a number of capacities. They're very useful panels. They're very helpful to us. They do intake for us. But pro bono, we cannot look to pro bono as the way to achieve equal justice under law in Wisconsin. One reason that the providers work well, in my opinion, is that there are certain characteristics that the major providers share, and those enable the providers to use the funds efficiently and productively, and that's what will happen with this $850,000 or roughly thereabouts that will be generated. The providers have staff with years of experience. There's specialized expertise in poverty law areas. The providers have created sophisticated intake paths that make it easy for clients to get to the expert. There are rational triage systems. There are diversified funding bases now. We have computerized case management systems, and we have sophisticated data collection and grant administration capacities. And I say all that to make the point that what everyone thinks of the size that the $50 assessment will generate, the size of the fund, it'll be very efficiently and effectively used, including to incorporate pro bono work. We do all the screening of pro bono cases. So when we send a case to a private attorney, and they don't, private attorneys don't want to do income eligibility and the initial screening. Another point that I'd like to move to is that we do not need a study. We do not need a study. We do not need a study. We've done studies.
Counselor, are there uniform standards throughout all of the organizations funded by WIS staff on the criteria for permitting legal services at a reduced fee through your agency or the other agencies that are funded?
There are many. I can't speak for every single other provider, but many of the providers do use our income eligibility and asset eligibility guidelines.
Okay, so nobody's gotten together, nor has WIS staff ever asked you what your guidelines were and in any way compared those with what another agency that they're funding might be.
So WIS staff has asked us what our guidelines are, and we've provided them, and they know what our guidelines are. I'm not certain whether they've compared them to another provider or not, but they do know what our guidelines are, and I've had other providers ask me, what are your guidelines, we'd like to adopt them.
Mr. Abbott, you've indicated, I think you repeated it three times, we do not need a study, we don't need a study, we don't need a study. But as I understand the problem, I think you're correct that you probably don't need a study to indicate that you're in crisis status, but I'm not aware of a long-term solution that has been proposed to deal with the problem. And don't we have to look at this long-term?
Certainly, and the solution's money.
What is, and that's a very good question, Justice Butler, in the long-term, in looking at the amount of money you mentioned, what do you see 3, 4, or 5 years from now? What is going to be... Because you've been, talking about crisis, I think I've been a member of the bar for many years, and there has been a continued crisis in this area. So what is the, because one thing troubles me, and yes, it's $50, but it could be $500. Is that enough? What is enough, and what is the long term? Your long term, I'm not asking you this is not speculation, but since you're in this area, what is your answer, or what do you anticipate?
Well, with the caveat that it's virtually impossible to plan long-term in this area. Things happen with every political change and every budgetary change and every war. Budgetary things change, and so the legal services position in any government's budget changes. So what we have looked at in terms you'd have to say intermediate term strategy, and that's where this assessment comes in. And I made the point in some of the submissions. This money can be used to leverage significant other funds. In the past, we've used WISTAF funds, around $220,000 of WISTAF funds, to leverage over $1 million of other funds. You can't get HUD money or VAWA money, Housing and Urban Development money, or Violence Against Women Act money, or Victims of Crime Act money without either providing a match from some sort of local funds or operating costs. They won't pay your secretarial staff, or they won't pay your rent, or they won't pay your utilities. WISTAF dollars and LSC dollars are like gold, because we can parlay $1 into maybe not always $5, but $3 or $4 or $5. And so part of the strategy is to try to get as much of this general operating money as possible so that we can bring in, and I think in one of my submissions, this $850,000, if that were carried out, could generate over $4.5 million. The other part is we're doing it now. We're going to the governor and the legislature to try to obtain some state appropriations that are long-term. But those appropriations, as we've experienced both in the federal level and the state level, go up and down. And I've distributed our funding since about 1976, and you'll see the roller coaster nature of that. Now, the wild card...
If I may be permitted,
Chief.
Ms. Benke made what I think might be a valid point, that if we start assessing over a long period of time the bar in this area, doesn't that send a message to the legislature and perhaps the governor that, well, we don't need to take care of it because the court's taking care of it?
Sends the other message to me. It sends the other. We're always asked, whether it's by corporate donors or legislators, well, what are your lawyers doing? Are they doing anything for this? Because why should the taxpayers pay if the very people that are most concerned with justice aren't doing anything? And so when we can say, as we did with the Equal Justice Fund, the lawyers are right in there, they're pitching, but it's not enough, it's not going to be enough, and so we need state appropriations. It's an argument in our favor to have the lawyers doing this, not against us.
Mr. Abbott, your time is up. Are there any other questions? Thank you. And thank you for your submissions. Mr. Charpaglini, Wisconsin Legal Advocacy. Morning, counsel.
Members of the Honorable Court, good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Robert Charpaglini, and I'm a paralegal, and I appear for Wisconsin Legal Advocacy. It is an agency I formed in May of 2004 after serving a tour in the Wisconsin State Prison System, where I became an advocate on a host of prison-related issues. There I saw firsthand the raw consequences poverty has on an individual's attempt to secure justice by accessing the court through counsel. Preparatory to my appearance before the court this morning, I submitted a letter to the court explaining why I support the petition of the Wisconsin Trust Account Foundation. I'm not before the court this morning to discuss the constitutional issues, if any, that the petition may present. I'm here to discuss the common sense the petition does present. Poverty ought not be a barrier for a citizen, whether confined or not, in securing justice. The legal community as a whole has a moral, if not mandated, obligation to ensure that access to the courts in civil matters by citizens who poverty has befallen is assured to him or her. Pro bono services are becoming just as popular to attorneys in this state as is the month of April to taxpayers. No one enjoys paying taxes, but it's part of our membership in this great country of ours. It's ancient and it's required. Funding for legal services for our poor is hen's teeth rare. It's frighteningly scarce. The lack of funding often means that many disadvantaged citizens with real and tangible legal problems never make it to the courthouse doors. Their inability to navigate themselves through the shoals of our legal system often deter them from ever attempting to obtain relief of whatever sort from our courts. The right to be heard ought to be the right to be heard by counsel. Wisconsin attorneys entering their noble profession promise to provide pro bono services for, among other things, the public good. The comment to Wisconsin Supreme Court Rule 26.1 includes the following reminder to all lawyers. Every lawyer, regardless of professional prominence or professional workload, should find time to participate in or otherwise support the provision of legal services to the disadvantaged. The provision of free legal services to those unable to pay reasonable fees continues to be an obligation of each lawyer as well as the profession generally. And in concluding, it states, every lawyer should support all proper efforts to meet this need for legal services. I believe that the Foundation's petition is just such an effort, which the State Bar now opposes for reasons that seem to be a bit exaggerated and speculative and perhaps even shameful. The petition seeks merely to require each attorney to pay an annual $50 fee to help fund the foundation. The projected revenue that it would generate would ensure that more of our poor experience the greatness that our judiciary has to offer. The $50 annual fee is so modest that it is quite hard to fathom why the State Bar would even raise an eyebrow. The requested fee can only be seen as a condition of a lawyer's promise to provide pro bono services to the disadvantaged. It is certainly not a tax, as some have suggested. Membership to a state bar is a privilege burdened with conditions. Lawyers are received into that ancient fellowship by something more than private gain. They are in that fellowship to promote the interests of justice and to see that all citizens, regardless of the size of their wallets, are able to seek redress for their grievances. No lawyer should be at liberty to even pale at the thought of contributing funding for agencies whose missions are to provide legal services to the poor, and few, it is hoped, would be disposed to do so. I believe that the answer to Mr. Glenn's question as to what the member's mandate is should be nose on the face plain. To promote justice by funding agencies striving to meet that end. The Foundation's petition is simply fraught with good for the people of the state of Wisconsin. And it is worthy of this court's solicitude and an order granting the same. I do take issue with one thing with the Foundation, and that is that it appears that that funding that is available is not made accessible to prisoners of the state of Wisconsin in civil matters. Having served substantial time in that system, I've seen firsthand the many needs that prisoners face of a civil nature, whether it be divorce, child custody issues, bankruptcy. Trying to find an attorney in those type of matters is like trying to find a needle in a haystack. It is very, very difficult. I believe that if the petition is granted, that the Foundation should apply those funds even handily all across the board and not discriminate as to where those funds go or to what segment of society is targeted. On behalf of all the disadvantaged citizens who seek their day in court, represented by competent counsel, in matters where the right to counsel is not absolute, I vigorously encourage this honorable court to grant the relief the Foundation seeks. And as a parting note, to all those members of the bar who have strived to provide pro bono services, I thank them.
Are there any questions? Well, thank you very much, Mr. Ciavarlini, for your comments today. We'll turn to Juliet Brody, Clinical Assistant Professor, University of Wisconsin Law School. Ms. Brody?
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court. I am Juliet Brody. I'm an assistant clinical professor at the UW Law School and director of the law school's Neighborhood Law Project, which provides free legal services to low-income people here in Dane County in what we consider bread-and-butter issues of poverty law, principally landlord-tenant matters, wage and hour, that is, unpaid wages and overtime, and public benefits matters. The morning is getting late, and I don't want to just read or resubmit what is in our written submission. I'm here on behalf not only of myself, but on 15 other members of the UW clinical faculty, all of whom have dedicated our careers to providing legal services to under- and unrepresented people across the state, and also to the education of law students. I want to add two voices, if I may, to what we've heard so far this morning. One is that of legal educators, and the other is that of our clients. I want to, as legal educators, we as clinical faculty, we see our function in the classroom, which is really the courtroom and the interview room and the clinical office. We're teaching students at least two things, twin important functions. One, what we consider the skills of lawyering, how to conduct a competent interview, how to adopt a set of facts to a legal standard and make a persuasive argument. The skills, the technical features of being a competent attorney. But second, we also are part of teaching our students about this ancient fellowship, or increasingly sisterhood, of lawyering, that they are taking their place in this profession with its special duties. As legal educators, we listen to speeches every year at convocations, at graduations, about this fellowship, about the special duty, about how this is not just a social program, to underscore what Mr. Ebbett has said, that law is one, our legal system, our democratic system of justice is nothing less than the way in which we distinguish ourselves from barbarians. This is who we are. This justice system makes America what it is. And without access to it, it becomes, if not meaningless, severely compromised. This conversation about the duty of lawyers to the poor, to people who otherwise would not have legal services, is an important part of legal education. We take this very seriously. So do our colleagues, as they say, on the other side of the house, in the classroom, who aren't engaged in a clinical practice with real clients. But as this is what binds us together as legal educators, is to convey these twin things to law students. You must become competent. You must know how to do the job. But you're also a guardian of core principles that make our civilization what it is. Now, no one in this room is going to disagree with that. And part of this conversation is the legitimate debate which you're hearing today about how lawyers should discharge this responsibility. And I think we would all agree that the entire burden cannot fall on lawyers. And certainly for a buck a week, or even some sense less than a buck a week, this isn't going to solve the problem. What the petition does, though, is seek to at least try to close some of the gap that has happened in very recent history. If you look at the numbers in the petition, we're really in a crisis of having lost a lot of money, and our clients are going every day unrepresented while we debate this, while we have this legitimate debate about mandatory, voluntary, whose burden, all of that. This brings me to the second voice that I think needs to be heard, which is, again, as others have said, no one here is opposing this petition because poor people don't need lawyers, or it's not important, or there isn't legal need out there. But I nevertheless think it's important to put some faces to this problem. Today is Wednesday in Dane County. Tuesday in Dane County is Eviction Day. It's Joinder Conference Day in Small Claims Court in Dane County. I wasn't there yesterday, but I'm there a lot of Tuesdays. So is my colleague, Marsha Mansfield, who's here today, and so are our students. And we go, and every Tuesday we see bodies lined up, filling and spilling out in the conference room of the Dane County Small Claims Court, waiting for their eviction case to be heard. Now, many of those cases have no defense. Let's just assume they're non-payment of rent. They haven't paid the rent. They're there to cut a deal, to make a payment plan, to set up a date on which they can agree to move. But for some of them, service was improper. For some of them, it's mistaken identity. It's the management company got the name wrong and served the wrong person. For some of them, the party wasn't in their apartment. The dog isn't theirs. There's a defense. This family, without an attorney, is very likely to be put out of its home by operation of law, where there was a case that could have been made. Now, again, no one is here. I know I don't mean to suggest that any opponent to this of this petition doesn't care about that. But I do think it's important to put some details on what we mean about people going unrepresented. These are people who are working 65 hours a week and never getting a dime of overtime, who don't know their rights, even if they know them, don't know where to go, don't know how to fill out the form, don't know how to argue against, don't know how to analyze documents produced by an employer that are clearly doctored, don't know how to identify. We're trained in those skills. And when we in the law school say, welcome to the fellowship, you're going to learn how to analyze these documents. You're going to learn how to present your arguments to the court. And you're also going to protect core values of our democratic society. That's what it means to be a lawyer. And sure, the devil's in the details. And we can debate this, and there's arguments on both sides that have merit. But yesterday, a lot of people went unrepresented, and today they will too. And $50 a year, it's not going to solve the whole problem. It's going to help make up some of the ground that has been lost. And we, the 16 signers of this petition, urge you to support the petition.
Any questions for Ms. Brody? Justice Brass.
As a professional in the field, what expectations do you have for judges?
I hadn't thought about it. As members of a bar, to discharge the duty that they have, I haven't really thought about it, and I would hope that someone else here might answer that really good question. I don't know. Judges generally don't engage in their own private practice, I assume. So certainly to take on an eviction case that's going to go unrepresented wouldn't be part of it. So I'm going to defer on that to someone who's thought about the issue.
Well, do you think we ought to be required to pay as part of our dues the $50, if that's what the court does?
I don't see why not. But I'm sure there may be arguments why not. But the members of the judiciary pay the regular membership fees? Dues?
But generally, yes. Yep. With some exceptions. We all do, not necessarily.
We can opt out of the lobby.
Right.
Of the bar.
Right. We have free speech. Right?
Yes.
Some. I see from the statistics two justices do. Thank you, Ms. Brody.
Thank you.
Bobby Peterson, Executive Director, ABC for Health, Inc. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you and good morning. May it please the court. I'm Bobby Peterson, an attorney, public interest attorney, and Executive Director of ABC for Health. We're a nonprofit public interest law firm located here in Madison, Wisconsin, but we serve families and clients across the state. I've listened carefully to the testimony, and I'll try to zero in on a couple of points that I think will help to inform the court in making your decision. One of the things that really came to my ears as I was listening is what I perceive as the real need for leadership. Leadership, vision, and wisdom, and I think that's why we're here before the court today, because right now it seems like it's lacking. I think it's lacking in the position put forward by the State Bar of Wisconsin. I think it doesn't address the needs of low-income families and individuals that go without representation in this state. And I think we face a crisis in leadership in trying to serve the needs of people seeking equal justice under the law. At ABC for Health, we've served over 10,000 families in the last decade. Requests for assistance, people having trouble getting health coverage for their child, people denied insurance inappropriately, sometimes by fraudulent means. People that have been sued for medical debt that wasn't theirs, yet it's on their credit report, and we all know that the credit report now is the modern age electronic debtor prison for low-income people. You can't move, you can't buy a car, you can't get a credit card. You're shackled to a credit report that may be invalid. Those people need help and need redress. The petition from WISSTAF, I think, moves in the right direction. We've all heard today that it isn't just a lawyer's issue. But I maintain that it is an issue where lawyers must lead. We have a responsibility as attorneys to lead the public on some issues. And this is one of them. I think for us to stand back and say, we're not going to do it, we're not going to step forward, $50, we don't want to be told what to do? Excuse me? Our profession is regulated. We are told what to do. The people that we work with are told what to do. We live in a society regulated by laws. For us to say $50, we don't want to be told what to do, let's make it voluntary, I think that's ridiculous, or it's a red herring because people don't want to pay the $50. I think the assessment is part of an ongoing process. I agree with what John Ebbett said, and I just want to amplify that a little bit. I think it's an opportunity for us to make a statement. I think it's an opportunity for us to take some leadership. I think it's an opportunity for us to send a message to the general public that this is one step in a process that must engage the public. But it won't engage the public if we stand back and say, not our problem, let's study it for a while longer. Let me tell you about studying it for a while longer. We've seen our legal services budget drop to $16,000 for this year. That's our entire legal services budget. In 2001, we had nearly $100,000 to serve the legal needs of families and children with chronic illnesses and disabilities to make sure that they obtained, maintained, and financed their health care. We challenged abusive practices. We took on abusive collection practices. We're barely able to meet any of the needs that were that are coming into our office today. Sadly, our existence as an organization is seriously compromised. This is going to be part of a broader solution. It's a $50 assessment. I think we need to raise awareness. But I think mostly we need to look to the court for the vision, the wisdom, and the leadership on this issue to address the glaring inequality of access to justice in this state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any questions? Justice Prosser.
Could I ask you, Mr. Peterson, has there ever been any equivalent presentation to the legislature, any legislative committee?
Well, I think that John Skilton presented some information that was provided to Governor Thompson about legal services, getting support for TANF funds to support the delivery of legal services. There was a comprehensive commission that Mr. Skilton led to address some of the needs, the legal services needs. The legislature has been approached recently. Governor Doyle has been approached, as I think Mr. Skilton also addressed, that we do have a crisis in legal services, and we're looking for partners to help us solve these issues.
I mean, what I'm really asking is there one person, 132 members of the legislature, who has ever introduced a bill and had a public hearing on this sort of thing?
On civil legal services?
Yeah.
Not to my knowledge.
Oh, but you got $100,000. I think it was $100,000.
Right. It was passed. I don't think that there was a... I don't know how it was introduced.
Bill.
I think it was part of the budget bill.
As I remember it. State Bar worked for that. Very hard, as I remember that also.
Yes, they did.
Of course, there's a crisis in criminal justice, too, in that the legal, indigency standards are at a figure, in the 80s, 1980s, or that don't match now, and that even at that level, payments for private lawyers who work for the public defender are very low, probably don't meet the overhead for many lawyers, but they take the cases anyway, and that there's a great need in the criminal justice system, which the legislature has been advised about numerous times from the state public defender's office, supported by the bar and supported by this court, that the indigency standards needed to be redone. The court has not taken part in any of the civil justice discussions.
I don't mean to rebut the Chief Justice here, but I would say at one time I served the Speaker of the Assembly. No one brought to my personal attention the fact that the indigency standards in criminal cases had fallen as badly as they had. And to the best of my recollection, no one ever came to me and discussed the kind of issues that you're talking about. I have to say right out that I'm a little concerned that the court is often being treated as another legislative body. I don't like that. It's not to say that your cause isn't very legitimate, but...
I recognize and appreciate your concerns, and I think that this problem needs to be addressed by multiple points. I think the court is one point of the process and one point of a solution to get us to a point where we can provide better access to legal services for low-income people.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. James Botsford, Wisconsin Judicare.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Seeing you.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court, starting with the fact that I'm going to be very brief. My name is James Botsford. I'm the Director of the Indian Law Office at Wisconsin Judicare. I'm here speaking for all of Judicare today, as our Executive Director couldn't be here due to a medical circumstance. Wisconsin Judicare is the LSE-funded nonprofit law firm that represents low-income people in the northern 33 counties of the state, and we've been there doing that for nearly 40 years. I've been in legal services over 20 years myself, the past 13 in my present position. Through that career, there's been a kind of a consensus nationally that when times were relatively much better in terms of our funding, we were hitting about 1/7 of the need for civil legal assistance to low-income people. The situation is now much worse. We provide less service to the client community than we ever have since I've been there because of funding shortfalls. Mr. Skilton raised the motto, equal justice under law. It is a very powerful and promising and encouraging phrase. Every year, that phrase has decreasing validity to an increasing number of people. No meaningful access to justice means no faith in the legal system. And no faith in the legal system means no respect for the law. As my son says, it ain't exactly rocket surgery for crying outside. You have the WSTAF petition. Then, too, is the Civil Gideon petition. There are recommendations of mandatory pro bono or pro bono reporting out there. This is all very indicative that the wheel is squeaking. We and our client communities are turning to you because you have the loftiest view and the power to craft part of the solution. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Botsford. Are there any questions? Does anyone else wish to appear in favor of or opposed to, partially in favor and partially opposed to the pending petition? Mr. Skilton, you may wrap it up. Mr. Skilton, I'm going to ask you a question because I was intrigued by one of Justice Process's questions about where you could do a set-off against the $50 for, I'm thinking about all my set-offs. One of the problems I ran into is, as I remember the commission that you set up in which I served, one of our little problems was we couldn't define pro bono. Was right. True about putting out a mandatory or a permissive report form. It was very hard to define pro bono. It's not as hard to define cash, although there might have to be a list of entities that would have to then be defined with pro bono. So what are your comments about that in addition to everything else you were about to say?
Well, first of all, I think it might have been Justice Prosser, maybe it was another justice, who said that the court in the end controls the bar dues and how they're allocated. And the question of whether there are projects that the court views should be funded or whatever, it seems to me it's a matter that the court can't address. $50 is not a magic number. It's almost symbolic of an issue. If I may, I would like to address a couple of comments directly to a couple of questions Justice Prosser asked, because I think he challenges the petition in several ways. I'll start with the proposition that I think that everyone who's in this room comes with a sense of humility that it may not have been done right yet, and that there are ways that we may not have thought of that should be pursued in pursuit to a common cause. So whatever we do today, it is with an open mind. And with respect to the legislative process, it may well be that we need some help here on how we're doing it and who we're doing it with. With respect to the first one, I am aware that the issue was lobbied. I think George Brown was very much a part of it, if I'm not mistaken. We were working heavily with the committee that was involved. Gwendolyn Moore, I think, was on that committee. I believe John Gard was. They were contacted. Perhaps we should have talked to persons higher up. But it wasn't a matter of not trying to make the case. But having said that, it may not have been done right. So the first point, I think, is well taken and constructively put. The question of whether the court is acting like a legislature here is a real question, I think, because you're saying, hey, why do we have to tax lawyers in a way? Isn't that for the legislature to tax citizens, and you're coming here and asking us to get money? My response to that is twofold. First, it seems to me the court can look at it a little differently. The court can say to the legislature, as part of our budget, we want $850,000 because we have citizens of this state who aren't being served by the lawyers. You can do it another way and work it through your budget if you think that's a better way to do it. Same result. The court has options here, and I respectfully suggest, as a matter of our open-mindedness here in this discussion, that the court ought to look a little bit about how it can help in the process. And I mean that respectfully, because I know the court is very concerned, and all of the justices are concerned about this. But there may be ways the court hasn't looked at it. And I'm talking now about filing fees, for example, or side prey, or issues that are within, and I am aware of some certain and some sufficient, and the funding issues this court has to deal with directly just to get its budget approved. So I say that with humility, but on the other hand, I say it with a sense that this is a problem that confronts us all. So if the bar hasn't come to the right solution or WSSTAF hasn't, let's find one that works. I want to also comment on your very real question about tsunami or world trade. And it seems to me that I respectfully, I'm going to wave a book at you. Some of you have it, some of you don't. It's because of whether you were on the court or not, I hope. It's a book that we sent to the court, 7 copies. And it's The Integrated Bar, the Wisconsin Story, 1943 through 1997. It has the blood of some of us on it, probably. But the point of the matter is that in this response, I'm going to try to refer you to how the bar itself manages the tsunami question. Because, in fact, the bar makes this decision almost every Board of Governors meeting that it has as subjects come up. And the question is whether it can be charged or not. There is, in fact, a constitutional committee. There was at my time, and I suspect there still is, wherein the board assesses its activities at year end and goes through the process of determining which charges are simply not appropriate and which are ones for which the bar will make a dues reduction and which are ones that are political or ideological and which ones are related under the Thiel analysis the Puerto Rican case, which is really to say here is the continuum that the bar works under, and it's in response to tsunami and world trade. That which is political or ideological is not chargeable. That's why I raised the issue of unless it has a absolute and direct link, and oftentimes the bar bends over backwards anyway and doesn't charge for it and or permits arbitration to proceed and makes reductions as a result of it. But the keystone of prohibition for the bar is the constitutional First Amendment issues of association and speech. The second level of analysis is it reasonably related to the core purposes of the bar? That's Thiel, and that's this Puerto Rican case that Thiel adopts. And these three cases, by the way, Levine to Proceto to Thiel, are the federal courts, in combination with Keller, are the federal courts' analysis for Wisconsin, if you will, of our bar's activities. And so the second level basically goes to the question of reasonably. I actually, Justice Bradley, I had to litigate the question of the constitutionality of a $50 bottle of wine consumed by a bar president in San Francisco. That's how specific the bar is on that. By the way, the answer to that, it was reasonably related to core purposes.
Well, in California, every wine is.
Well, in fairness to the court, and as a matter of full representation, it wasn't a $50 bottle of wine, but that's neither here nor there. And you go from that continuum then to saying things are simply not related to the core purposes. And so how the committee would, in my day, evaluate your question, long-winded answer, is to say that the bar's purposes are defined by this court's statute, that rule that regulates the purposes of the bar. Those are our defined core purposes. And if you read them carefully, they talk about delivery of legal services. And what is the word, Justice Wilcox, that when you and I did the two-step on the oath, what is that word without regard to?
Lucre.
Thank you. That is core purpose stuff. So when I give the core purpose, I mean it sincerely, that tsunami is a long way away, and it's a cause that isn't directly related to the delivery of legal services to the citizens of the state of Wisconsin and within the regulatory power of this court, which is why it's a mandatory bar in the first instance. We are a regulated entity, we lawyers. And so if it's core purpose, I'd say tsunami wouldn't have passed our committee. And I don't know that World Trade would have either. I think if World Trade had occurred in Madison, Wisconsin, we might have had a different situation.
That was my example.
And so the bottom line to this, and the reason that I bore you with this kind of presentation, is that there is an element of regulation. And, yeah, there may be better ways to do it. You know, probably there are, and we ought to find them out. And it may be, Justice Butler, that we do need to really look at this again. And there are better ways to do it, and we haven't found them yet, but we do have a need here. And we, if you look at it like the little boy with his finger in the dike, that's maybe where we are at this point. So we got to do something. We can't ignore it. And it's for this court, in my opinion, to send whatever message has to be sent, that whether or not a $50 fee is imposed, it is not optional to ignore the problem. It is not appropriate for lawyers, many of whom are, as we throw the stars in the water, returning them manyfold, and some of whom do nothing, truth be known, to ignore that problem or view this as a voluntary organization. This court has to speak on this issue.
Mr. Skilton? Thank you for your time in the petition and today, and thank you to all the speakers today for their thoughtful remarks on this issue. And the court also thanks many who have communicated with the court by written communications, in addition to your all or in lieu thereof. Now, we'll take a few moments to set up. My plan is to, before we break for lunch, deal with another open administrative matter, namely the Court Improvement Program, which is a federally funded program with matching funds. And then probably we would finish that by noonish and then come back at 1:30 and deal with this issue in open administrative conference. Then you all can plan your morning and afternoon accordingly. With that, we're in a few moments recess. The hearing is adjourned, and we're in recess before an administrative conference.